You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 296. And in this episode, I chat with Dr. Nicola Petrocchi about compassion-focused therapy, or CFT, specifically for OCD. So Nicola did a study where recently for people with OCD, and it was a group study, and they were specifically looking at treatment-resistant clients, so people who have done at least 6 months of CBT and not seen the improvements they wanted. And we discuss why he chose those people. And we talk about his therapy journey. We discuss what is compassion-focused therapy, the evolutionary view of the mind, how CFT fits in with other therapies, his study, including what is it, what he found. Then we discuss viewing OCD from a compassionate lens, the science behind compassion. We discuss different types of guilt, different exercises in CFT, working with the inner critical voice. We discuss some of the resistances to doing CFT and much more. And thanks always to NoCD for supporting the show. I deeply appreciate it. If you want to find out more about NoCD and their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. So thank you to Nicola for his time and to you guys for listening as always. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Nicola.
Welcome to the show, Nicola.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And what when I get sort of a therapist on or a researcher, I initially like to ask them what got them in to being a therapist or a psychotherapist. And it'd just be good to hear your journey.
Oh, yes. It's I think my personal life and to begin with. In a sense, I am... you know, there's a good part of our dysfunctional childhood. So the good part is that you become curious of several ways on how to help yourself, how to help maybe other people. And I remember when I was very young, I actually became very curious of meditation techniques and self-hypnosis techniques to kind of help myself in moments where I was, you know, not in such a good place. And so after that, I decided that it was interesting for me to continue and explore, and I wanted it to be more consistent in my life. So I decided to study psychology and to understand the science behind that. And this is how I approached university. And then, of course, then you change your mind because there are a lot of theories. And then at the beginning, you get confused about, okay, should I become a psychoanalyst or should I become whatever other type of therapist? And then gradually, you know, I realized that I wanted to go initially into the CBT mindset, and then I was trained in CBT. I became a CBT psychotherapist, and then I finally found compassion focused therapy.
Nice. And do you still use a lot of CBT based interventions and tools within your CFT work, or have you kind of forgotten CBT?
You know, the good point of CFT, the good point of compassion-focused therapy is that it was never designed to replace evidence-based therapies. It's actually, it was originally thought and designed to, I would say, boost and empower therapies, especially when some techniques and some therapies don't take in account the motivational system, the social mentalities that could be active in a moment. inside the client and between the client and therapist. So in a way, that's why I love CFT, and that's why I love to teach CFT. It's not another therapy approach. It's not like another bunch of techniques that they work better than others. No, it's not that. It's more about helping us therapists and also us clients to understand how the type of motivation, you know, the type of intention that we use to connect with ourselves and with others, actually that type of variable, the motivation, influences our mood, our way of thinking. And that, so the thing that I like is that basically you can use all the CBT techniques. For example, sometimes I use cognitive restructuring, but I would say I use a compassion-focused cognitive restructuring. So I would say that I'm doing my best to use that technique that we know it's useful, but from the perspective, you know, of we have a tricky brain. It's not your fault if you have this, built-in biases, and etc. So trying to remember that even a simple cognitive restructuring could trigger a sense of shame in the client, a sense, you know, of, why am I so stupid? Why did I understand that before? It's, you know, so I think compassion-focused therapy is such a powerful approach exactly for this reason.
Yeah, well said. And my next question was going to be, if you could explain to the listeners, you know, what compassion-focused therapy is. And I guess for the listeners, I'll also say throughout this interview, we'll both probably say CFT, which is just compassion-focused therapy. Yeah. So just roughly explain what it is. And then also, I think what the reason I like CFT, I really like the evolutionary basis for it. Yes. That kind of, yeah, if you could just kind of just mention that as well, that'd be good.
Yes. I think it's thank you for the question. It's very intriguing because at the moment there are many models of compassion, and we are all in, you know, attracted to mindfulness and to these several quote unquote techniques. Mm-hmm. You know, but the problem with techniques, and this is why the evolutionary approach at the core of CFT is so important. The problem with techniques is that they can be used inside a specific motivational dance. Again, I could, for example, and this is how CFT started with Paul Gilbert, I could use, for example, cognitive restructuring with a client, but I could not realize that the client is using a super self-critical attitude to, you know, convince herself or himself that, you know, that technique is useful. So it's important, and this is how CFT started, to start realizing that before we look at each technique and before we apply the technique and or along with applying the technique, I also can focus, I can become more aware of something that comes before. And what comes before a specific technique is the type of motivational system, the type of social mentality that is active in me as a mammal and is active in you, client, as another mammal, and is acting between us. And indeed, what the evolutionary approach of compassion-focused therapy tells us is that before thoughts, before having, you know, the ability to speak, before having the ability to communicate, we actually, as mammals, as a species that is a social species, we are built with specific motivational tendencies that, in a way, come first. You know, we all have also viruses, I would say, bacteria and mammals in particular. We all want to defend ourselves. We seek safety. And these also viruses seek safety. Or we seek nutrients. We seek, you know, resources. Social species like mammals, we also seek safeness, meaning that we have this basic evolutionary-based need, you know, motivation to feel a sense of connectedness and safeness. And I think that compassion-focused therapy, what it's really trying to tell other approaches, that no matter the technique you use, you need to remember that as humans, we are modulated, we are shaped by these three basic motives, and we need to remember that in therapy. Otherwise, a lot of techniques will not work. And so compassion-focused therapy was developed as a way to help humans, as us, mammals, to build a particular type of motivational system, a social mentality that is compassion, because we know that when we cultivate, when we train that specific motivational system, we can use our mental processes, our metacognitive processes at the best of our capacities. And so we are, for example, more able to realize that no, there is not a threat in that specific element. And I'm more able to inhibit my very automatic threat response. And so we become wiser. And at the core of compassion-focused therapy is that there is the assumption that we can actually train our bodies and our brains and our minds to go and to act from the perspective of that motivational system that is compassion.
Yeah, I like that. And I mean, that's why it's relevant for OCD. That kind of threat system is just firing, you know, like the amygdala's going off. There's danger, you know. And that's why I like the evolutionary perspective for an OCD lens. It's like your amygdala, your brain thinks there's, you know, a tiger in the room, so to speak. It can't tell if there is one or isn't, but it's saying there is. Trying to calm down or quieten that threat system. Anyway, that was a ramble, but I think that's kind of why I liked your study. So let me get my question out. Has it gone? So yeah, so you did a study group compassion-focused therapy for treatment-resistant OCD. I want to hear about the study, but the first question I have is, why focus on treatment-resistant OCD and not people with OCD?
Well, because this was a little bit of an ethical choice, because, you know, we realized, and this is interesting, because one of the authors of the study, one of the people that helped us during this study is a super strong cognitive behavioral therapist in Italy. Like, he is, I guess, the most famous cognitive behavioral therapist in Italy is Francesco Mancini. He's the author of many books on cognitive behavioral treatments of OCD. But this is how I think smart people work. Like, they are open to new, for example, to new inputs. So he became interested in compassion-focused therapy because he realized that even if cognitive behavioral therapy and with all the exposures that implies, even if it works, there are, of course, limitations to that type of treatment. And so he heard, I was trained in school, and then started like cultivating my passion for compassion-focused therapy, and he became interested in our approach, evolutionary approach to OCD, and it felt like it would be interesting to test with OCD clients. But what kind of OCD? Okay, when you start with a pilot study, in a sense, you don't want to start with a treatment that we don't know if it works or not. And because if we had started with a group of OCD clients never treated, and imagine that we found out that it didn't work out, we would have done something not very ethical, because we would have postponed for them the possibility to have an effective treatment. So we started very like conservative and said, okay, let's take the most difficult clients. That there are clients that have done all the CBT treatments, that have done at least 6 months of exposure. Let's see if what happens if we help them cultivate their compassionate mind. And that's why we had this first idea of starting with this group of clients.
Yeah, good point on the ethical. I almost don't detract from the study, but like the questions are coming up for me are, is there any plans to take it further? As in, now that you've proven that there's been some impact on treatment resistant cases, that actually let's take it to people who haven't had any treatment yet.
Yes, absolutely. So this is happening actually at the moment, right, where we're talking because in Padova, you know, another group, research group that was a little bit inspired by this first paper, they decided to test the same intervention, but not on eight sessions. They decided to do a 12-session intervention, which is now the, I would say, the minimum for applying compassion-focused therapy, the treatment. And they decided to test intervention with people before they had the typical CBT treatment. And so basically we are now trying to understand if it works or not with this kind of clients before the exposure. And I can already tell you something that is incredible, because they presented this the data in a recent conference that we just presented last week. And what we know is that, yes, it works. So even if they did not do the exposure, like giving them the possibility to train their compassionate mind already reduced in these clients symptoms and already reduced self-criticism and increased their ability to self-reassure.
Yeah.
Okay. And the point, however, is that the reduction in symptoms was slightly, it was less than our study, where they also had the ability to do the exposure. You know, they knew that they had to expose. What does this mean? It means that this is actually the confirmation of what compassion-focused therapy is, and Paul Gilbert always highlights. That is, compassion-focused therapy is not a replacement of evidence-based treatment. We want simply to add, to boost evidence-based treatment with the awareness of what happens inside of the clients while, for example, they do the exposure. So it's crucial, because sometimes we hear therapists thinking that, you know, this is another school of therapy and, you know, we are all the other evidence-based therapies are kind of the, it's not a competition. It's about how can we, you know, empower, you know, and this is what it was nice of this recent data.
Yeah, I agree. It should always be about the truth and getting the best outcome for the client. You know,
absolutely.
It should never be dogmatic. And yeah, so what comes to my mind is, I guess the next stage is maybe a study where it's merging CBT or ERP with compassion-focused therapy. So I remember John Abramowitz and Michael Tuhig looked at merging. They merged ACT with ERP and did a trial, and something similar like that for CFT would be wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, for example, what I envision is our next step where, for example, you do the ERP and maybe you teach the client the rationale, but at the same time, you have the client to maintain a compassionate mind while they do the ERP. So, for example, imagine yourself doing the ERP while your compassionate image is close to you, or maybe with the perspective of your compassionate self. Or imagine training also the therapist in maintaining a compassionate dance, a compassionate relation with the client while they do the ERP. Because sometimes you hear therapists doing these procedures and they can become, you know, we all kind of become a little bit like either, you know, patronizing or a little bit of like encouraging, but in a sense of like, not in a way that I would feel encouraged by. Let's put it this way, or slightly critical. Okay, and I envision probably a merging that is not just putting one therapy plus the other one, but more about, okay, be aware of the type of mindset, the type of motivation that also you as a therapist have while you guide your clients in doing exposures, okay, and the ERP.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's almost the therapist is bringing a CFT, like energy, into the room. So it's not about tools anymore. It's the energy. In the same way, like Carl Rogers with the core conditions, you know, that was an energy you bring into the room to have empathy and unconditional positive regard and all of this. It's not necessarily a tool. It's a way of being. Even Carl Rogers said that, you know, and almost that for CFT.
It is like that. And also that plus maybe specific techniques. I would, for example, imagine, you know, the compassionate image close to you while you do the ERP, or other type of techniques that we've used, for example, in this group during the treatment. For example, I would ask clients to write compassionate letters to their OCD. Because sometimes as clients, we criticize a lot of ourselves for having the disease in the first place, as if we've chosen it. But we didn't. The clients didn't. And so it's interesting to use, for example, the tool of compassionate letter, but a little bit transformed. And instead of the compassionate letter to me, maybe the compassionate letter to the OCD, as I can picture it, or maybe to my OCD self, you know, to the part of me that is, you know, so worried about the OCD worries, and what could that part of me would like to hear from a compassionate self? What kind of phrases would make that part feel more at ease and, you know, willing to act?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love that. And also often, sometimes in the community and in my own journey for many years, I saw OCD as a bully. And it wasn't until 5 years ago, I started to probably less than that. I started to shift that away from it being a bully to, I won't say what, because I think, but it's like, it was much more compassionate, I guess, is how I viewed it as. It's ultimately trying to protect me. It does, but it's doing a bad job of it. It's overprotective and it's scared itself. And when you think the OCD is scared, it stops being this monster and it starts to be this thing that almost needs you to not love it, but to care for it, almost like a small child.
Yeah.
That helped me. I don't want to push that onto everyone, but that kind of.
Absolutely. I also believe that what we've seen in our group with 8 clients in this paper that we, you know, published is that actually was a major shift for clients. And, you know, I'm not gonna name the other types of approaches, but there are some approaches, for example, where they teach people sometimes to fight self-criticism or to fight OCD. And it was pretty evident that there was a threat system activated by that procedure. And that it was much more productive to help the clients use their compassionate mindset to look at their OCD or, you know, their self-criticism. And that usually it's when clients told us, is when a patient tells you like, oh, I never thought I could look at that part of me, you know, from this perspective. I thought I should fight it, or there should be something that I needed to delete.
Yeah.
Get rid of. And so this is what sits at the core. So as you said, you know, you kind of said it like, it's not really love. It's not that I end up loving my OCD, or it's not that I'm going to end up loving my self-criticism. It's not about love. I mean, as Paul usually says, there's nothing wrong about love. But the point is that I can still, even if I don't love my OCD, I can still try. And this is a direction, is an intention. I'm really willing to see the suffering behind that. And I'm willing to see the fear it stems from. And I'm as best as I can, I'm willing to connect and try to heal that fear, trying to you know, to connect with the part, with the vulnerable part of the disease. And that helped a little bit.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Because, yeah, we often, and as I talk, I'm aware that some people may be happy with the idea of seeing it as a bully, and I don't want to take that away from them. They can, if that's useful for them, they can absolutely keep it. But I think sometimes we externalize OCD, and I'm guilty as a therapist. I do this with some of my real young clients. I'll get them to externalize the OCD. And I think in a way that can be helpful because it gives them something to label it as, you know, this is what's good. It's the OCD. It's whatever the name is they've given the OCD. But I think externalizing it too much is... it stops us from remembering that actually the OCD is us. It's our brain. It's not separate to us. It's and if there's some pain that's driving that, then giving compassion towards the OCD part of us maybe is more likely to do a better job of healing it than rejecting it.
And let me tell you, like, I totally agree with what you're saying also. And we have two things supporting this. We have one study by one colleague of ours, Julia Almanova, from Bratislava. She didn't really work with OCD specifically, but she did a distinction between self-protection and self-compassion, you know? And self-protection is what we use against a bully, and self-compassion. And we know that self-compassion was better in increasing heart rate variability, so the ability of the vagus nerve to generate a sense of calmness and inhibition, positive inhibition of the threat response. And this is exactly also the point that we want to reach in the treatment, because at the very end, it's not that we choose compassion because, you know, compassion is cute or because it sounds better, but simply because, like, there is a deep there is a big physiological change that happens in a body when you choose to activate a compassionate motivation. So it comes with an increase in your vagus tone, an increase in your the ability of the prefrontal cortex to inhibit the threat response. And so there is an increase in oxytocin, we now know. And so physiologically, like if you go into compassion instead of, for example, into fighting, it seems like it's almost like you're choosing the right chemicals. I mean, if you wanted to go to sleep at night, you wouldn't take 5 coffees if the goal is to fall asleep. You would want to have the chemicals that would help you in the process. Yeah, and yeah. And this is exactly where compassion works, because compassion motivation activates a physiological response that typically slows down your heart and helps your brain to inhibit the threat response. This is exactly what we want.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you can do that, then you're getting yourself out of that anxious fight or flight state.
Yeah.
So I've detoured too much. It'd be good to hear about your study now, and sort of anything you want to share about it. You know, but I guess let me direct you a bit, like roughly what it consists of, you know, like 8 people and then I guess what you found would be good.
Yes, yes. So basically, as I told you, a little bit of introduction is that we knew that OCD, that ERP worked, but we also know that there's a lot of, you know, half of the patient seems to benefit of the treatment, because there's a lot of refusal, dropout rates, and we know that. And basically also what we observe is that in this particular study, we highlighted a specific emotional feature of OCD clients that is actually has been researched here in Italy from Francesco Mancini, who's this professor here in Rome that studied the role of fear of guilt in OCD. So because the point in OCD is that sometimes we tend to highlight too much the intrapersonal, purely cognitive determinants of the disease. Mm-hmm. So for example, the role of negative appraisal and stuff, but we tend to overlook the importance of social and relational elements to OCD. And indeed, for example, there's a big history of looking at OCD and, for example, the obsessions and the compulsions as a way to try to stay away from the experience of feeling guilty. Mm. You know, we have a little bit of intolerance of the emotional state of guilt. And in particular, Francesco Mancini here in Italy, like, did a lot of interesting study that basically distinguished these two types of guilt, which is fantastic and very intriguing for compassion focused therapy, because basically said, he found out also with fMRI studies that we can feel guilty in a way that is a little bit of a pro-social flavor to it. For example, if I say something wrong against you, and I feel guilty and I want to recuperate, I feel, you know, I didn't want to do it, and I'll do my best, and because I see you suffering, and this actually activates a little bit of a prosocial response in me, and it's called prosocial guilt. But if I find out that people are also able to experience a sense of guilt that is called deontological guilt, which is a guilt that doesn't come really from hurting anyone, but it really comes from, for example, breaking some rules. Even if nobody, you know, nobody cries, for example, there are some examples. I don't know if we have time to go through them, but if you do, for example, something that is completely not relevant, so you go with the red lights in the middle of the night, you are in the desert, and the cars, they don't pass there. And some of us could still feel guilty for having broken that rule of, no, you cannot pass with the red light, okay? You need to wait, for example. And this type of guilt is the type of guilt that doesn't include necessarily someone that has been hurt, but includes breaking rules. And he found out that people with OCD, they tend to be specifically sensitive to this kind of guilt. So basically, there is a kind of a specific fear of experiencing that emotion, okay, according to this specific theory. And it's interesting because it's not the prosocial guilt that they're scared of experiencing, but more the deontological guilt. And so we reasoned that, okay, maybe if we help these clients to experience compassion for themselves and to activate the soothing system, you know, this part of the brain that actually is responsible for making us feel that we are slowing down, that our, you know, threat response is regulated. So if we help clients, for example, to experience compassion for themselves, maybe they will be also more able to accept higher levels of guilt, because maybe they say something like, okay, you know what, I will not do my compulsions. I will try to stay away from washing my hands, because even if I end up feeling guilty for having caused, you know, some kind of, for having broken some rules, I will be able to forgive myself, because I will be able to soothe myself. I will be able to connect with my compassionate self. So if I have this safe base, you know, if I know that I can rely on my compassionate self, at this point, I can risk more, you know, and I can afford to tolerate increased level of guilt, deontological guilt, because, or at least I will be able to tolerate increased level of anxiety regarding, oh my God, maybe I will feel guilty, but who cares? You know, if I feel guilty, I eventually be able to give compassion to myself. So we basically realized, okay, if we help clients, especially in group, to access this self-soothing ability, they will also be able to stay away a little more from their compulsions. Maybe the obsession will come, maybe a little less, but also they will be able to stay away from them. And this is exactly what, in a way, what we found. So we took these clients. They were actually amazing clients, very courageous. We told them, no, this is the first compassion-focused therapy group. So we are, you're like pioneers. You need to help us understand if this works or doesn't work. And this is a cooperative also mindset, like, please help us. So we help you, but you need to help us. And basically, we started this 8-week compassion-focused therapy in group. And we did a multiple baseline design, meaning that we assessed, it was a very small group, so we assessed two assessments before the groups and two other assessments at the end of the group. And unfortunately, the very final follow-up was in the middle of the first lockdown. So it was a little like complicated, because at that stage, it was the government telling you to do compulsions, like to wash your hands. So yeah, we were like desperate, because it was like, okay, how can you disentangle? But with much of our surprise, it worked out, because we were able to find out that there was a reduction, significant reduction on symptoms of OCD symptoms. But also there was a reduction in fear of guilt. So compassion help them to be less scared of experiencing this negative emotion, and so more courageous. And we know that compassion is courage. And sorry, interrupt me, because I tend to talk a lot.
No,
so
that's okay.
Tell me if
a couple of things that come to my mind. One is, yeah, it's really bad luck for your study that the end of it came when that first lockdown in Italy happened, which was what, April? End of March, April,
yes,
2020. Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, I thought about this earlier, because I knew this would come up on the podcast. And I thought, if you took everyone in Italy or even in the UK, because we then locked down pretty much straight after you guys, I think, and you took a baseline of everyone in Italy's anxiety levels, like a week before the shit hit the fan, so to speak, with the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks into it, you did everyone's anxiety. The average baseline is going to be way higher, so the average anxiety marker. So, like, I guess what I'm saying is, for your study, is statistically it was going to impact it, like, you, because everyone was, most people were anxious, not just people with OCD. You know, because no one knew what was going to happen, or if it was the
no
end
one
of the
knew
world.
What's gonna happen. Yeah. No one knew, but there, you know. There's always a bright side to things, right? So consider that it was funny to realize that towards the end of the group, there was a bizarre cheerful feeling in the group while COVID was approaching and the lockdown was approaching. And I think it's connected to the sense of common humanity, that basically this COVID-19 things like triggered in us against our willingness, I would say. And I still remember one of the final sessions, I was like, this is magic, because I still remember this group of amazing clients talking to each other at the very end, and like everyone anticipating, like, oh, have you heard, next week we will have to, you know, lock down, and still they're asking us to wash hands. And the funny part was that one of them amazingly kind of said something like, hey guys, did you see? And everyone was like, yeah. And me and my the other co-therapist, we were like observing this fantastic connection. And it was like, now they are all like us. And now I even have one client said, after 3 hospitalizations, now, so before I was the weird person, but now people call me and ask me suggestions on how I should wash my hands properly. And I found that was such an amazing way to also to connect and to actually say a big truth. We are the results of the social environment. So in this specific moment, all the world was exposed to this influence and made us become all a little bit like obsessive, OCD, you know, actors in it. And so it was funny because, yes, it was negative, but at the same time, for some of them, it was slightly alleviating to consider that a lot of people at that stage had their same fears.
Yeah, really good point. And that brings the question to mind. So did everyone have sort of contamination-based OCD, or were there other themes of OCD?
No. So basically, I don't remember completely, but I have, you know, I came prepared. And so there were actually every type of obsession, I would say. So there were doubts and accidental harm and checking. So there was mostly this type of obsession, but also thoughts about unacceptable taboos and mental rituals. Some clients have this specific type of fears, some contamination and washing, and some other of symmetry, arranging and counting. So I would say that it was pretty much...
Yeah, good array.
All types of obsessions, I would say.
Yeah.
And nice. They also gone through different types of therapies, mostly CBT standards.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. The other question I had on the study, just to kind of bring it to life for people, is in your actual paper, I'm not sure if it's open access or whether you need like...
Yes, it is. Open access is in Frontiers of Psychology.
Oh, okay.
So you can download it. And
yeah. All right, cool. Well, anyone listening, I'll get the link and I'll put it in the show notes. But yeah, in that you break down roughly what you do in each session, which is really good. But if there was any sort of like highlights of things you did, you wanted to share just to kind of bring to mind, because most people listening know what a rough ERP session would look like. You know, what are some of the things you were doing from a CFT point of view?
Yeah. So what, thank you for the question, because I think it's the most important part, you know, of the job that we did, because we, first of all, we helped clients understand the unchosen nature of the brain. So literally the first part of CFT starts with reality checks. And I know that you feel weird, that also you are treatment resistant. So you must feel extra weird about, you know, not like working well with this treatment that they say it's so wonderful, CBT is so wonderful. So we started with, it's not really your fault. You haven't chosen that. And we started with meditations and reflections on it's really true. We don't choose that. And on top of not choosing our brain, you also didn't choose all the family experiences that we know for certain have generated the specific sensitivity to guilt. So, and it was incredible how they would talk to each other about, oh yeah, that's true. This has also happened to you. Your family was like that. So it was a little bit of a like common humanity sense of, oh, maybe it's true. You know, maybe it's not me. It's not that I don't. It's not that I'm lazy, or it's not that I, you know, I'm choosing not to stop my symptoms. That I really didn't choose my brain. And also for them, it was intriguing to look at the three circles and the fact that, because of course CBT doesn't cover that. And they looked at, okay, you have these obsessions, you need to do an ERP, they explain the rationale, but basically they're not helped in understanding how there's a specific system that is the soothing system that could help them in that. And again, this was not chosen. It has been chosen for us. I mean, we did not choose to have an undeveloped green soothing system. So we said, okay, you know, this is the reality and we need to train it. And what they liked a lot, because in compassion-focused therapy, we do a lot of pair exercises, and it was really amazing because we asked them to visualize the critical part, and like we do a lot in criticism in compassion focused therapy, to look at the critical part and trying to see really what it does to us. And then we asked them to write, each of them, a compassionate letter to their critical part, kind of like, okay, thank you very much. I mean, I guess you've tried somehow to protect me. it was not very effective. I have to say, actually, things turned out to be worse than before. But you know, I'm trying to connect with you from my compassionate perspective. And so they wrote a letter to their critical part, and we would ask them to, in couples, to put a chair and to read the letter to the to the chair that was the critical part. And the other person, the other colleague, like looking at them, you know, witnessing the, and that was amazing because we were like hearing, and that was amazing to hear how naturally, when clients are helped approaching that mindset, they naturally come up with compassionate words and compassionate intentions. So that was very, there was a super shifting moment for them.
Yeah, I like that. And sort of breathing, breath work, and like soothing rhythmic breathing and all of that. Was that in most sessions or was that a regular part of the practice?
No, it's a part of each session. Actually, we start every session with the breathing, you know, going back to the soothing breathing rhythm and to the three intentions of compassion-focused therapy. You know, I'm here because I'm really committed to alleviate my pain, to help myself, but also to do something that might potentially help others, but and also to be open to the help that might come from others. So we start with breathing, soothing breathing rhythm, and with the focalizing these intentions, which sets really the motivation. And then we would have a topic for every session. We would do exercises, and we would you know, help them incarnate and embody their compassionate self, to walk on the room, and imagining, for example, being in front of their triggers, the typical triggers that would trigger their, you know, their compulsions, but with their compassionate self. So, for example, we ask them to experience how the compassionate self posture could help them while their obsession would pop up. And so they realized, for example, that if they remember to breathe, to connect with their soothing breathing rhythm and to change their posture and to change their facial expression, the obsession, yes, they would come, but they would have more ability to you know, stop the compulsions, and so they would have more control over it. And we would say, you see, it's the soothing system helping you, sustaining you, and compassion is really helping you in this.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, thank you. So this question actually comes from a friend of mine called Johnny, who is a therapist and he uses CFT a lot. He wants to know, was there any sort of fears, blocks, or resistances to doing compassion work from any of the participants?
Oh, absolutely, yes, actually. As we know, in compassion-focused therapy, there is no compassion-focused therapy without resistances to compassion. You know, that's actually the core work of compassion-focused therapy. So resistances came from the very first session, to the point that you really have to commit to yourself and say, okay, resistances to compassion are not a mistake. I'm not doing anything wrong. It's actually at the core of the part. So most of the resistances were in, first of all, so one typical resistance was that they would not trust themselves. So as every OCD clients, we of course have the tendency to say, okay, I'm experiencing this sense of alleviation of my pain, but am I really experiencing this? Yes or no? Or maybe am I faking it? You know, the typical doubts that we have when we are in our OCD, you know, ourselves. And so we had to help them experience compassion also for this doubt. So because we had to help them say, when you have these doubts about the whole process, this is not a problem. This could be welcomed in the process itself. And so we helped them understand that, again, this was a protective part of them. So there was not mistake, was not something to avoid. The second type of resistance was mostly linked to give compassion to themselves, because they basically have this sense of being responsible for not doing enough to heal, or you know, I am, you know, without hope, and this specific group of clients, they were, you know, like, you know, I've done all that, and this, if this didn't work out, what else? Yeah. And so a lot of resistance would come with the voice of, you know, just give up. No, it's not helpful. It's not going to help. And at that stage, it was like a little bit of a depressive resistance, I would say, you know. So a part that is like, I'm tired, I'm sad, I don't want to try.
What's the point?
And then again, like helping them say, can we experience compassion also for this part? Mm.
And, yeah, I like that. And I'm guessing a lot of resistance in the form of compassions. It's like airy fairy is the word that comes to mind. It's like woo woo. It's out there. It's how's it going to help me? You know, it's just, it's fluffy. It's like mindfulness. It's
Exactly. And this is usually clarified at the beginning, because we had to say, remember, you know, compassion is really courage at the very core of it. So, you know, if you feel that self, you know, touching your own body and activate the soothing system or you know, repeating soothing phrases is something fluffy, just remember the physiology behind that. Just remember that is your way to try to navigate this very ocean. So it's a courageous thing you're doing, and so we had to go back there very often. Thank you for reminding me this, because yes, that was a problem. And sometimes they were very skeptical, because like, oh, I've tried CBT, which is the best of the best of the best. Why should I try that? And what you tend to love also in the qualitative results is the group connection. And but group connection that was colored with compassion, because, you know, you can gather in a group and do a fantastic group complaining, or okay, let's do a group self-victimizing activity. So you can, you know, sometimes the group is not just the group, is what kind of motivation colors the group. And in this group, we were able to notice that people would really start using compassionate skills to help each other. And so we would hear from small chats before the group. And so, of course, we need to do more qualitative studies on future, you know, experiments with bigger samples. But we already could see that it really can shift how they experience their social connections.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I like that. One other thing that comes to my mind is, and you mentioned it before, like the harsh inner critic that frankly most people on this planet have. It's not just people with OCD, you know, but with OCD especially. Either from the study or from just in your own work with CFT, with other people, how do you work with that really harsh inner critic that's really sort of criticizing and judging and putting the person down?
Absolutely. So thank you for this discussion, because actually it makes me highlight one important thing. So the first thinking in the OCD clients is that they seem to have two types of critical ruminations. And I think this is important. So the first thing that was addressed by compassion focused therapy was the type of self-criticism connected to like, how could I have been so careless? I couldn't have thought ahead about in such content, for example. Okay. So this is usually the first way the OCD clients criticize themselves. But then there is a little bit of a secondary criticism. And also we address that with compassion focused therapy. It is the secondary criticism regarding, I'm crazy. Why am I doing all this compassion? I'm ruining my life. So criticism, it's when criticism becomes, you know, explosive. And the work is always about helping them realize that it's fear, comes from fear. And helping them realize that it doesn't come overnight, but it's literally trying to observe the critical voice with a compassionate perspective. Like, so I know it's difficult. I know maybe today you will not be able to do that. But again, let's try to close your eyes. Let's try to visualize this part of yourself that's telling you this. What is really behind that? What sits behind this part? What is really scared of? How could we possibly approach this part with compassion? Oh, I don't know. I don't know how to do that. Yeah, I know. I know it's hard, and I think we need to take care also of this part that is tired of that. But if you could tell only one word to your self-critical part in front of you, one word that could basically make this part feel slightly more at peace, calm, what would it be? Or do you have a color? So if you can produce any word, do you have a color that could surround that self-criticism and make it feel more nourished? Or and that's it's what I thought. What I realized is the repetition of this procedure is not like that comes
once.
It's more about going back to the rationale, to the idea of extending compassion to self-criticism. And gradually what I notice is that with people, because people have the idea that self-criticism can reduce like with like a kung fu move, like, okay, let's do this technique and that's it. But, you know, it's a language, and there are no easy techniques to learn English. You know, I learned English over the years, and I really don't believe in people telling me you don't learn English overnight. There's not such a thing. You need to practice, and you need to forgive yourself for ups and downs, but you need to say, okay, time is crucial here. I need to do it more and more. And this is the mental training that is at the core also the Buddhist tradition. It's not like, oh, I have this inside and that's it. I'm done with self-criticism. It doesn't work like that. It's a practice.
Yeah, that's a good illustration. I mean, firstly, your English is very good.
Thank you.
You've clearly worked hard on it. If you think about having that compassionate dialogue with yourself, it's a process, and you're relearning how to speak to yourself effectively. Yeah.
Exactly. This is crucial, sure, because sometimes I always tell my client, like, do you speak any other language except for Italian? I was like, yes, English. Okay. So did you learn with one of these magic techniques that teach you English overnight? Like, no, they don't work. Or one of the machines that you wear while you sleep and teach you English? No, doesn't work. So what did it work? Practice, exposure to people talking to me in a compassionate way. And so it's going to work the same way. So be patient with yourself, because like learning self-compassion is like learning a new language. And this alleviates a lot of like, okay, but you've been repeating me this for many sessions. Why haven't I learned this? And I was like, because it is not supposed to be that way. It's supposed to be repeated. And this is how I learned, and this is how you will learn.
Yeah, very good point. It's probably why I've never learned a second language, because I start and then give up.
But I think it's important. I that reassured me a lot when I was, for example, learning how to sing. I was like, it's okay. It's not about it. It's not an intellectual understanding. It's more of a practice.
Yeah. Yeah, very. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's showing up and putting in the work. So slight change now, very different change. If you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you say to them?
Oh, such a beautiful question. I would say, don't worry, my dear. Don't worry, I will be here waiting for you. And all the suffering that you're experiencing, you will understand it. And by 42, you will be more free, you will be happier. And you are amazing, I love you. But so don't worry. Now everything is very confused, but everything later will become much more clear. And enjoy, I would say that.
Yeah, compassionate phone call. And then you've got like an advertising billboard in Rome. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Advertising for what?
Anything you want. It's just a message. It's just you're communicating a message. What is that?
Oh, I like these kind of things. Like, I would say, stop and find three things you're grateful for in this very moment. Because I think that gratitude is the corresponding emotion of compassion, because when I'm grateful about something, I'm grateful about a compassionate act of someone, like, oh, I'm so grateful that Stuart asked me this question because it helped me connect with my 20 years old man. And so compassion and gratitude, in my opinion, are very much connected. And that's why sometimes I use gratitude as a way to remember how many people have been compassionate towards me today.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, good one. Okay, and then lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have said or shared today?
Really, thank you for your work. Like, I really appreciate that. I feel very much sustained and comforted by webinars like these and by podcasts like this, because I listen to them while I wash my dishes, while I wash brush my teeth. And I think that your commitment to do things like these are truly a compassionate commitment, because they bring voices to people, and we humans are helped by this. So thank you very much. This is my
thank you. That means a lot. Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it. So thank you so much for your time. You know, I read your study and I really wanted to get you on, and it's been wonderful to share it with everyone listening.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.